Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Percussion Loft, the podcast from Gonbops, the leading percussion instrument manufacturer since 1954. I'm Rich Mangiacaro. So glad you could join us as we hear from the world's greatest drummers and percussionists. Let's get started. That track is from today's guest, Colombian-American musician Willie Calderon, from his new Grammy-nominated album, L.A. Impromptu. A very personal project, Willie assembled some of the world's greatest musicians to bring this album alive, including fellow Gonbops artists Alex Acuna, Ilya Lazo, Luisito, and Roberto Quintero. He even had his friend, acclaimed actor Bill Pullman, to record a spoken word piece that leads off the album. Willie's appeared on various hit TV shows, including Bones, Jane the Virgin, and America's Got Talent, and has scored music for the Nintendo Company, and he also worked on the editing team for Hans Zimmer. His performance credits include work with Grupo Niche, Sublime, Earth, Wind & Fire, Tony Sukar, Bruno Mars, just to name a few. We're excited to welcome this great multi-instrumentalist to the Percussion Loft today. Here's my conversation with Willie Calderon. Willie.
Yes.
How you doing?
What's up, man?
Man, welcome, welcome.
We're here.
We're here. We're doing it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That track you were just hearing, everybody, is called Ifa from L.A. Impromptu album that Willie just came out with. We're going to get into all about that record and the creation of it a little later on, but congratulations on that, man. It's a fantastic record.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks so much.
I mean, that track is just killing. Great track.
Dude, Luisito Quintero killed it on there.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, so good. So how are you?
Ah, man, I'm doing well. I'm working on a lot of projects, getting motivated to create more music. Already looking to the second album.
Okay.
Doing this stuff right now, so yeah.
Second album for the orchestra?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
Well, this particular project took quite a while, right? It was like 5 years in the making?
Yes. You know why? Because it was my first really strenuous, really, you know, stressful baby, I guess you could say. Because honestly, I spent most of my time doing this record to get all the people that were on the record, like 30 artists, 30, 34, 35 artists, different artists around the world. I had to take my time and I had to keep refining each track as time went by, re-recorded because, you know, I would update my studio and I would get better equipment. So it was just like 5 years of just like refining and polishing and updating until the final project was okay to release in my head, man, because I'm my worst critic. I'm sure we all are, but I'm a really bad critic of myself. Everything has to be the way I want it, perfect. This album, everybody that's heard it, you know, all the interviews, all the reviewers, they're saying it's great. It's one of the best things they've heard and da 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 da. To me, it could have been better. So
that's interesting because, well, first of all, I think we all are our own worst critic. Mm-hmm. And when you're working on something like this, especially something that you kind of envisioned And you said something about, you know, as time went on, you got better equipment, you upgraded things, I could do this differently or this better. I think we all go through that, especially when we evolve, right?
Yes, it was all an evolution, man. I mean, 5 years is a long time to evolve. Even my playing style,
exactly,
technique, my sounds on the skins and stuff like that. It all changed in 5 years. So I was like, man, I could do that conga way better now.
Yeah,
you know, because now I know where to place the mic better and this and this and that. So it was all that, dude. Like I re-recorded like maybe 2-3 tracks. So that's a lot of work in itself.
Oh, know? Yeah. I mean, also look at the logistics of what you did with getting that many people. I mean, was it predominantly remote recording or did you have some people in person?
I had to have some people in person, because of their, you know, situations, you know, studio situations. A lot of people don't have studios yet. And that's understandable, you know, but with Adonis Panther Calderon, I had to go to Cuba, get the studio out there and have him come in. And we did that, you know, personally. With Luis Conte also, you know, I went to a studio because, you know, just for direction, things like that. And just because, you know, he's my friend, so we vibed and we just chilled a little bit. So that was fun. With Luisito Quintero and Robert Quintero, I managed to get them in the studio at a NAMM show. So they were going to be in town and they already knew they were going to be on the record and they already, you know, had agreed. So we did that during one of those, you know, those slow days at a NAMM. So it was a mixture of a lot of stuff, man. Like I even had to go to Japan to record a couple of artists. And it's, you know, that's what took so much time, you know? Well,
that's pretty exciting to be able to, you know, first of all, go to these different locations and, you know, bring your hard drive, you know, bring your files. Okay, yeah. Now we're going to do it here. I mean, it gives the record a character, I think, because, you know, when you do a record in one space, the whole thing, you know, it's one thing and it's one kind of character. There's an aspect of this album to me is a very live kind of celebratory album, you know. You can feel it. You can feel the celebratory collaboration between all of you guys. I think that was something you probably really hoped for. Well, you achieved it because it really comes across.
That's awesome to hear, man. Like I said, I'm always my worst critic, and when I get, you know, the compliments and things like that, I take them, but I don't take them at the same time. But you know, you're a person I respect, so if you for you to say something like that, it makes me happy, because yeah, that's what the point of even the project is. The concept of the project, LA Impromptu, is really to have, it's a celebration between family, musician brothers, the brotherhood, you know, music from all countries and things like that. It's the mix. I had this one interview where the interviewer said it was the Fania All-Stars of the West Coast.
Oh, wow.
To me, that was huge, you know. I have my reservations on that, but it's not something that I don't want to achieve, you know. If people are starting to see that, I'm going to push it even harder next time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can hear the celebration. You can hear the... It's fun. It's a fun record, man.
It's so fun. Let me ask you a question about the writing and the choices, because that's one thing I thought was interesting is you have some covers and some originals. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of decide the direction on this? Did you start out with original music? And then regarding original music, do you start out by writing on a piano, or how do you conceptualize that? But as far as, you know, covers versus originals, what were your thoughts when you first started thinking about this?
So check this out. The track list from 1 to 12, because there's 12 tracks, it was all linear. So the order it appears on the album is the record is the order I thought of it in.
Oh.
So I didn't jump around. So I started with Mr. Magic. That was the very first thing I imagined in my head. I want to do a Grover Washington Jr. cover. I haven't heard no one do it. And I'm going to make it happen. And then, you know, mid doing that, I thought of the opening trombone lick for Ifa, uh-huh. which is the next, you know. So it's all linear. And I left it that way. I didn't change it around at all.
Sounds like you were trying to tell a story.
Oh, this album is definitely a story from start to finish. That's why, you know, it starts with that with that movie soundtrack introduction with my friend that we'll talk about later. But yeah, it's definitely a movie. And yeah, I always sit at the piano and just go over the licks, like go over like the intros and the brass section harmonizations and stuff like that. And then I just piece it together and it works. It's like a puzzle, man. It's a puzzle. My brain is organized in a very unorganized way. Like all creatives, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. But what you said about linear, you know, you when you were working on this idea and you were coming up with the way you wanted to see this, that's pretty interesting that you actually knew the order mm-hmm. when you started it and you had this in mind and how one thing would lead into another thing. And
I believe a lot in if you feel it, just leave it alone, right? It's a balance between having a feeling and having that epiphany from the universe or from energy, from God, whatever you want to call it, whatever you believe in, and just leaving that alone while controlling all the things that you can't control. It's a balance of those two. Mm-hmm. So I let the music just flow. I let the ideas flow. And then I acted upon that. So the ideas, the energy came first.
You know, I think the order of songs on an album, I think it's such an important choice. It's such an important decision if you're really thinking about, you know, an album concept as you're telling a story, or if you, like you said, you use the word movie. That's interesting that you use that word because, you know, a producer that I'm working with on actually my second album right now, we talk a lot about, man, that song is a movie. We're trying to come up with ideas and ways of crafting a piece of music so that it tells a story sonically, you know. Exactly. And so the fact that you spent time really thinking about how one song would lead into another and how it's going to tell the story, well, you achieved it because that's what this album does.
Humildemente, homenaje a Cachao.
a lot of people I spoke to, when I told them I was coming out with an album and it wasn't just singles, their mind was blown. They were like, what? Like, you're coming, how many tracks?
Right.
12. What? 12? Like it was unheard of or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that caught the attention of a lot of people. So I feel like it's going to come back, man. It has to come back full circle, because that's what life is, right? A cycle. Music has always been a cycle.
Well, so, yeah, that plus if you think about all of the people that influenced us musically, that's the way they create music. They don't come out with a single and then move on to, you know, something else. They come out with a whole album. You know, it's a. I mean, all the people that influenced us, that's the way music is created.
I'll take this opportunity to ask myself this question and answer this question, because I feel like it's pretty cool. What was I thinking? What inspired me when I was creating this album? You know what I was thinking about, man? I was thinking about Dark Side of the Moon. Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd. I was thinking of The Wall, how everything's linear. You know, everything, and you know, back in those days, they were gapless albums. I wanted to do a gapless album, but just the time frame I was in, I couldn't crunch everything in. But I might do a gapless album later.
Yeah.
Because it's always been something that music should be like a movie.
Yeah.
You know, it should take you somewhere for a cool hour, 45 minutes, an hour, you know?
Well, that's interesting. You just brought those influences into this, because I don't think a lot of people who know you would guess that is where this idea possibly somewhat came from, or what influenced you to come up with this concept. I mean, who would have thought of Pink Floyd when they think of this record? I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. I think it is pretty cool. I want to see more albums done that way. You know, I want to see more albums done that way. Like yours, like the album you put out, those soundscapes, man, like, I know you've been told this a lot of times, but it takes you places, you know, especially when you're driving.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm driving through the canyons or through on PCH, when I'm going up to San Francisco or something like that. Just put that, it's like a soundtrack to your life.
Yeah, I kind of think that way when I write. Actually, the next record has that too. But this is going to lead me into a question for you, because and I know you are too. I'm a big fan of film music, and I really love when I watch a film how the music brings it alive or gives the film a whole other character or whatever. Case in point, check this out. I just have to bring this up. This new movie that is out on Netflix right now by Jane Campion called Power of the Dog.
Okay.
The soundtrack, wow. It's written by the guitar player for Radiohead, Johnny Greenwood, and he's the same composer that did the soundtrack for There Will Be Blood, if you saw that movie with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Okay.
If you check out these two movies, the soundtrack is another character in itself. It's really an incredible thing, and that kind of stuff really moves me. And so you've done some of this. You've done some writing for video game and worked with Hans Zimmer.
Yes.
Talk a little bit. Let's jump into that for a second. Talk a little bit about scoring.
Yeah. Well, thinking about that now, I guess all that plays an influence in how I do things. 'Cause it's like, it has to be a story, you know? Check this out. If I could quit doing live gigs and do one thing, it would be sitting in my studio composing video game scores.
Yep.
Because that is that's my thing. That's my passion. So I got my feet wet in that. And as soon as I got my feet wet with that, with doing trailers, because I did some trailers for Nintendo, just the trailers, not the game music, because people have been confused. Once I did that, man, I was just like, wow, this is what I want to do. This is my thing. So, if there was one thing I could do, it would be just that. As far as film scores and things like that, I've worked with a lot of amazing people, man. Like being on the score team with Hans Zimmer. Another thing people have gotten confused, I didn't do the music because, you know, Hans, but he needs a score team. Every composer needs a score team. They need their orchestrator. They need the editing team, because there's so many pieces of paper. There's literally 2-3 hours of music.
Yeah.
Even so more.
Talk about that. What did you do with Hans? You were part of the editing team?
Yeah.
So tell us what that is. Tell us what you did.
We overview, you know, and this is a team of 100 people, maybe more. It could be as small as just going over the music and seeing if the pages are in order, if the scores are in order, if say they're going to record scene 3 on Friday, make sure on Thursday scene 3 is all, you know, for the cellos and violas and everything is all set up and in there, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So it was more of like a cool fly on the wall experience.
Yeah.
You know, paid, which is even more beautiful, right?
Right.
And then I got to see everything that's involved in that. Obviously talk with Hans, meet Hans, be cool with everyone on the team. Which obviously opened the door to other things, you know, meet people. It's the connections, you know. But that whole world, man, to me, that's the top. That just that whole creative space that they're in, to me, that's the top. You can be in a studio with, you know, 4 or 5 musicians, and that's great. But when you're listening to those instruments like violins and cellos and flutes and because it all ties into what you said, that's what brings life to the movie. So when you take those two things apart, the soundtrack should be able to stand on its own feet. So I'm listening, you know, I'm in these involved in these projects where I'm just hearing the soundtrack, not the movie, and just the magic of what you can create with music is that's what inspires me to just compose. Right. Like, that's why I would just do that.
Yeah. 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 Well, when you were working on the trailers for the video games, what kind of instruction or parameter did they give you? I mean, did they give you a lot of instruction or?
Yeah, you get the assets, because sometimes they want you to, you can either do just the music or the sound, sound effects, like sound design,
right,
in the trailer. So you get a pack of assets straight from the company. Assets being like the character voices and like the jumping noises and all this, you know, fun stuff. And then you basically see what you get the finished trailer. You get the finished trailer, no music, no nothing, and then you piece it together. But the fun part is watching the trailer with no music, but your brain is already working. You're already listening to, like, oh, violins in this part when he jumps. That part is in slow motion. Okay, we're going to bring the music to a halt. You know what? So you have to start thinking about, you have to put music to actions. Like, what? A game I play a lot is like jumping. What does jumping make me feel in like, with instruments? Like, what does jumping sound like in music?
Right,
you know,
right,
that type of stuff.
Right.
What does dying feel like in music?
Right.
Or sound like in music? That's the fun part, because I get to be as creative as I can. And I'm a very creative person. Sometimes you understand in live shows, you can't be too creative because less is more, you know, in the studio doing, you know, somebody's rock album or salsa album or something like that. There's parameters.
Yeah. Hey, let's go back in time a little bit.
Yeah.
You grew up in, is it Los Angeles or did you grow up?
L.A.
Yeah.
No, L.A., yeah. Man.
Uh-huh.
Here all my life.
Talk about your early influences musically. I mean, was it a family influence? Was it?
It was a family influence. All the family, all, you know, Colombian family, music every day. I grew up listening to everything, man. From salsa to cumbia to the Rolling Stones to Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd. You know, my grandma was, you know, her prime was the 70s, and she went to all those concerts, the Doors and all that stuff, you know. And she was, the first, what do you call that? Like the first migrant or immigrant in the family something like that. I don't know how to say that. I don't know.
Grandmother was the first to come over from Colombia?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So she loved the Doors and so I grew up with all that. And she also liked salsa, and funny enough, she would go to all the salsa concerts, and just her personality back, you know, her whole life has been very bubbly, very energetic, very, people loved her. She could light up a room. So a lot of these bands would just, you know, they would know her when she showed up at the concert. And she made really good friends with Jairo Varela, which was the founder of Grupo Niche, a very influential band coming out of Colombia. And they'd be at the house. They'd literally, whenever they were here, they'd be at the house. And we have, you know, you have pictures of Jairo, me and his daughter and I are playing on the couch and stuff like that. So I had all these musical influences since a baby in the house, you know. Like my godfather, for anybody who knows his name, is from Colombia, is Fruco. Fruco is the pioneer in Colombian salsa coming out of Colombia in the 70s, 80s, now, you know, huge. We wouldn't have a lot of influence around the world if it wasn't for Fruco. And he just so happens to be my godfather because he was a really close friend of the family and all that fun stuff. So those influences just have been with me since my birth. Mm-hmm. And then I remember the turning point. I got into production because I was heavy in rap at the time, Dr. Dre and all that stuff. And I was heavy as a kid, like 8, 9 years old, hiding cassette tapes from my mom because she wouldn't want me hearing that kind of stuff. But I would get it anyway. I would listen to the production and stuff. And the turning point in percussion came when I was like 10 years old and I heard Santana, Abraxas. And I was like, what are those sounds that I'm hearing right now? And at that time it was Chepito on timbal. I think it was Peraza on conga and all that.
That's right.
I was just listening to, you know, all of these beautiful drums. And I asked my mom one time, like, what is that I hear in the back? And she would tell me, those are congas, those are timbales and stuff like that. And I remember I asked Santa for some congas. And there they were. And that was like the beginning of what this is now.
So did you start out on percussion or did you also play a little piano?
I started off on piano.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. I started off playing the piano, actually, because I was into production. And I had always, you know, I always had rhythm. I had a drum set when I was 8 years old too, but I would play with the piano a little bit more because mm-hmm. I could do more stuff, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, then I blended those two together, started producing stuff. And then I just got strictly into percussion. And now, you know, I do all of it.
Yeah.
Very happy to have those influences in my life. Cause, yeah, man, to make a living off of music, that's the dream, right?
Did you have any formal music training?
No, I did not. I taught myself everything.
Okay.
I polished it, you know.
Yeah.
You always have to polish it. You ask people for advice, what you're doing wrong, how could I do this better? And you know, luckily enough, you know, my references are people like Luisito, you know, Luis Conte, that I can call and talk to. Hey, what sounds better here? What symbol is better with this? What head is better for this? Blah, 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 blah. So those are my references today. I use those. When I think I was 23, 24, and I entered a little community college. I'm not going to lie, I didn't learn much because I already knew all of it. But I refined my reading there. It's funny, man, because when you teach yourself everything and as a percussionist that didn't go to school or anything, you know, you don't read. You often don't read. But I would get these gigs where I would get, you know, like mostly salsa gigs with a lot of breaks.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff like that. And I would get charts. And I'm like, what am I going to do with this? So I would just BS it. I would just BS it all the way through and act like I know what I'm doing. But through BSing, I actually learned how to read.
Really?
Because when you read, when you play music, like one, two, three, four, it all looks the same everywhere you go on every chart, right? And then there's these motifs that get used a lot in music, like the clave, pa 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 pa, right? You learn to know what that looks like on paper, so whenever you see it, you already know that's that. So you put all these pieces together, you start memorizing everything, and then you start actually learning about the values of the notes and stuff like that. And now I know, you know, more or less how to read. You know, I've had to go into studio sessions and they put the chart. And if I have to do it three times, that's a lot.
You saw it visually first and then you learn the note value after. Oh, that's what that is? And
yes.
Then because of repetition.
Repetition.
It's interesting.
And then I learned how to count them. I was like, oh, okay, that's why it makes da da. That's why it makes that, because it's this and this and that.
But what about when you're playing piano? I mean, was piano all by
ear? That's different. That's way different. I'm not gonna take any gigs that I don't know the music.
Right.
Because you can obviously read chord progressions, chord charts, and stuff like that.
Okay. But like when you were writing music for the record. And you played piano on the record, and you played,
right.
You played like the original music that you did. I think there's like four or five original pieces of music on the record.
Yeah,
right?
there's mostly the majority is original.
And then what about all the horn parts? How did you show the horn players the piano, the melody first, and did they help you?
So the way we did it, and that's why I love the guys I work with, is because we didn't have music recording it. We didn't. When you create the music, you already have everything. You already have the horn parts, you know, MIDI, you know, you MIDI it out, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is what I want you to play. This is how I want you to play it.
I see.
They learn it piece by piece. And that's how we progress through the track.
Let's still stay back in time a little bit. So when you were young and you were learning instruments and you were, you had a lot of family influence around you. There was a lot of music around you. You said that members of Grupo Niche were you know, hanging around with you guys.
Yeah.
Did you actually like start performing live when you were very young too? And what was that like?
I did, because of the influence and the family friends that I had that were already doing gigs and in music and stuff like that. I got called by my friend, family friend, guy's like an uncle to me. His name is Neil Benitez. And I'm so happy and so proud of Neil, because just a little bit backstory behind Neil, because I think he deserves it, which he would make a great Gombops artist, by the way. Hint, hint.
Spell his name.
Neil. So Neil. Oh, uh-huh. And Neil Benitez. Okay. Benitez.
Okay.
He actually just did, they called him to do the folkloric parts on Encanto.
Okay.
Because this guy is one of the best Colombian folkloric players. But the thing is, he has no exposure, right? Because he's not online. He's not. Mm-hmm. He's one of those guys. Hidden gem. And he's actually the one that put me into the music industry. He got me my first gig.
Which was,
dude,
what?
Imagine. Huh?
What was your first gig?
Yeah. Imagine this. Because we didn't know anything at the time. So they spoke, you know, he spoke to my mom, first of all. Because I was 13. And I got paid I think they paid her $120 to drive from Los Angeles to Reno. Oh. to perform in a casino. Totally ripped us off, obviously, but it was the in, right? That was the foot in the door.
Yeah.
So my mom didn't want to do it, because she was like, man, that's gas, like that, you know, like, not back then, nowadays maybe, but and I just told her, like, I have to do this. It was a conga gig. I was playing conga for a cumbia band, actually. It was a cumbia band. So it was a relatively easy gig.
Right.
With La India Meliara. She was one of the original vocalists for Sonora y Namita, which was also a global thing coming out of Colombia. It was a global. So I did that gig, and, you know, I did it right. I remember I would study all these songs, which now I hate to play. You know, I like this. Played them so much. I hate playing them. But it's funny, because that's where I started, and I'm always going to be grateful to that band, to Neil, to that music, because that got me my first gig, to my mother for driving me there. You know, I think she gave me, you know, I told, you know, she gave me, like, I don't know, $50 or something like that. And that was like my first $50 in music as a 13-year-old. Bought, like, I don't know what I bought, a backpack or something. So they kept calling me back, you know. Obviously, they already had their guys, their regulars, you know, in the band and stuff like that. But word of mouth, man, word of mouth got around. Hey, there's this young guy. If you need a sub, just call him. He's cheap, right? But you know, you gotta work your way up, you know, and that's what happened. That's what I did. Okay. That was thanks to Nate. So.
All right. So you played with some pretty well known people. Talk a little bit about how you got into some of these bigger name gigs that you've done.
Yeah. Like, how did I? Yeah, word of mouth. I've always been very prominent in what was the Latin world, salsa world, and stuff like that. I feel like there's two types of percussionists. Like, you're either like the Latin percussionist, like the salsa world, and then you do all the salsa gigs and all the, cause you know, I've done the Carlos Vives gigs and stuff like that. I've worked with Silvestre Dangond and all these like legendary Latin artists. Right. And then you have your pop percussionists.
Right.
Which, you know, I've delved into pop, but it just has not been my thing, and it has just not worked out for some reason.
Yeah.
mostly because my structure has always been like the Latin salsa world, where the percussion is everything, where right. the percussion is the heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, in the pop world, you're like the dressing on the salad.
That's you know? Right. That's right. But you've done that.
Yeah, I've done that. I've done that with a lot of,
talk a little bit about that, because I think that's interesting that, you know, you've done so much salsa stuff and so much Latin stuff, but you, when you dipped your toe into, like, I think I read that you had worked with Sublime or Earth, Wind & Fire
yeah.
a minute, and then Bruno Mars when I first met you, I think,
yeah.
which is quite a long time ago when you and I met.
You had
worked with Bruno. So,
yeah.
Talk about that approach, given where you came from.
Well, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
First of all, that's why those stints were very short.
Right.
Short lived.
I mean, Bruno's seems to lean a little bit towards integrating different styles quite a bit, though.
Yeah, but you know, as you see, at that point, there was no percussionist. You know, they were trying something out.
Okay.
Trying something out on some gigs.
I see.
And it just, I guess it didn't work out for both of us because they never went with a percussionist.
Okay.
You know, they still don't have a percussionist.
Right.
Sublime, you know, I wish I worked with Sublime like when you and they first started, but it was Sublime with Rome. That's like the after he died.
Okay.
And that's more like ska, reggae,
right.
a lot of timbal work, but still you're not, you know, you're just sprinkling your magic, you yeah. know, which is cool, but I like having to work.
Yeah.
You know, I like having to work, and my best example of that is Luisito Quintero, man. I know everybody loves this guy. Everybody's, you know, but I know him as a personal friend. That guy's my friend, and we've talked about things that, you know, personally, you know, I don't talk about stuff with anyone else. But that guy is just a reference to me because he is a power player. His roots are in salsa,
right?
You know, his roots are the driving factor, Oscar de Leon and all these people. But he can also delve in his own style, because I've never seen Luisito just do the minimum in a pop gig or anything like that. He adds his power, you know, working with Chick Corea and stuff like that. He adds his own power into it, where even if you're trying to do like a jazz thing, it becomes a Latin jazz thing almost, you know? So I think that I would, that I am this of the same philosophy.
Okay.
Picking up a shaker and a tambourine, I did it. I would do it again, but it's not what drives me. It's not my passion.
You put out a video that I shared once, not too long ago, that was cool. That was, you did a thing where you were coloring the music, and I think it was I don't know if it was a reggae thing or if it was a.
Was it the Sublime thing or the hip hop?
Yeah, one of those two things. But it was that you were just coloring the song, basically using different textures with a vibra slap or a tambourine.
Oh, yeah.
Or,
you know, that was actually I called it the 101 of hip hop percussion.
Right.
Yeah, because one of the major influences also in my production career was an album called Dr. Dre, The Chronic 2001.
Okay.
Where everything on the record, the bass, the percussion, they were real. They were not samples.
Right.
Right. Yeah, of course you get samples in hip hop and everything, but my friend Taku Hirano, yeah. another great percussionist, did the percussion from start to finish on that record. And I saw one of his interviews, and he said that Dr. Dre actually asked him to record the song completely with the percussion instead of like getting four bars and just looping it, which was something I really loved, because it gave importance to the percussion for the first time, honestly, in a major hip hop production. So that video was to show how those percussion grooves were made, yeah, using double row tambourines, flexitones. The flexitone sound is very prominent in hip hop music, right, yeah, especially on the West Coast. And that's all, you know, doings of DJ Battle Cat and Corrupt and all these guys that, you know, just added these weird tones and stuff. And it's all percussion, man. And so in that video, I highlight how all that stuff was, even triangles, you know, triangles are in hip hop. Congas are in hip hop. The moose call in hip hop is very prominent too. You know, Scott Storch used the moose call on a lot of records. So you hear all this stuff. So I was just highlighting those sounds.
Well, you know, what you were doing is exactly what you said earlier about pop music, basically. But you're basically coloring the song. You were, right, adding parts. But what Taku did, when you say start to finish, is that, you know, Dr. Dre let him go, and he just improvised. He just colored, yeah, the song with different textures. And, you know, I mean, this is something that all of our favorite percussionists do so well. Like for me, you know, growing up with listening to Lenny Castro or Paulino da Costa,
yeah,
or Ralph McDonald, these guys that, you know, go into a studio and they color the song so beautifully. They know exactly what to play where.
Right.
They just know what's going to fit where, what texture. You know, yeah, they listen very closely to the different sonic textures that are happening in the rest of the song and the frequency range where the guitar player is. And they may say, oh, this might fit better here or there, not to conflict. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the cool thing I think you were listening for. When you were doing that, you were showing people the idea of how to think about coloring a song with different, right, percussion textures, which is...
Don't get me wrong, I still do that.
Yeah.
I still do a lot of recordings, especially where all I have to do is color the song, right, and I love it. But you know, at the end of the day, I feel bad charging because I did just the right amount.
Yeah.
And they loved it. And I know that one extra thing will be too much.
Yeah.
So I can't. So I feel like I almost like, I don't know. It's just a dumb thing that is in my head, you know? As opposed to when I record timbal or conga for a salsa, somebody's salsa track, I'm actually doing the whole song, and I'm the power behind the whole song.
Well, you know, that you're talking about the percussion is replacing the drum kit, basically, as the driving,
exactly,
you know, timbal, conga, bell, bongo, that's the driving force in this music.
That's exactly it.
And it's the machine. It's the foundation of,
that's
of the whole,
exactly,
thing.
It is the foundation. So I could do both. Which one I like better is being the foundation, because I feel like I get more out of it.
Yeah.
But you know what? In both cases, less is always more. And I know everyone always throws that around, but it's true, man. I look at videos of myself playing maybe even, I don't know, 10 years ago. It's like I've come so far, man. I've learned so much. I've learned that less is definitely more. Being,
yeah,
just driving it in the pocket is just so much better, man.
And how effective space is when you use it.
Silence between the notes.
That's it.
Seriously.
So powerful. But, you know, watching you play over the years, as I've watched you play a lot, you know, your timbali playing is fantastic. Did you have certain timbali players that you really were really influential to you and like kind of took you into a place where you, because you and like, I know it seems like a very natural talent you have on it, but you must have had some cats that, oh, that is how I want to play that instrument, or just seeped into you, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I would say seeped into me. That's a great way to put it, because I don't actively try to imitate.
Right.
It's never been a thing. I've never been a lick player. I don't know if, you know, if that's a bad thing to say, but there are, I feel like there are lick players which will copy all the licks and do them. And then there's just right place, right time. I try, now my mature self is more down that road. So I reference people like, again, Luisito.
Yeah.
I reference people like Tito de Gracia.
Yeah.
Tito de Gracia. I reference also people like, let's see. You know, those, I guess those are my main guys. A lot of Colombian guys that I like how straight driven they play.
Right.
Very straight. No. There's no like too much going on. It's just very straight. Like Diego Gale, things like that.
You know, you're a very conversational player, even though you have tons of chops. But I think you think more conversationally when
always.
You're playing. I noticed that.
El sol, ya llega el momento de llegar a la isla en que todo realiza mis sueños. Esta vez no hablo de Cuba o Puerto Rico, es Japón, la tierra de fiesta, cultura y respeto. Tokio, la gran ciudad, bella y tradicional, ambiente sin igual. Y si quieres gozar una fiesta sin par, en Shibuya es que está.
You know, we've been spending a lot of time together with these guys, with Luisito and Gombops has quite a collection of great people, and you got a lot of them on this record. So
sure.
You have Alex Acuna on this record. You have Ilya Lazo on this record. You have mm-hmm. Luisito and Roberto on this
yeah.
record.
Exactly.
So let's talk about bringing all of their influences into this album. They did, you know.
They did.
I feel
like the album is a rhythmic Bible, musical Bible, because even though it's my record, and you know how it is when you produce your record, you're hearing these songs over and over and over. It gets to a point where it's like, oh, I don't want to hear it anymore.
I know.
You know, it's a little tiring, but I find myself listening to the record. Why? Because I'm studying what these guys did on the record.
Yeah.
You know, I'm studying the solos. I'm studying how they tuned stuff, how they recorded it. For example, on Ifa, I had Luisito do a solo in 5/4 time,
mm-hmm.
you know, with that take five feel.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to how he thought about it and how I would think about it. It's totally different how we would both think about it. But, you know, I'm immersing myself in listening to what he did and trying to understand where he came from so I could either learn from it or not learn from it or say, oh, I don't like that. I don't want to do that, you know? Because you can learn from the greats in both ways, not just all the good stuff. You can learn what not to do as well.
Yeah.
You know?
So, aside from all the great music and amazing performances on this record, you decided to do something really interesting with the beginning of the album,
mm-hmm.
With a spoken word piece with a friend of yours. And I thought this was really an interesting choice. First of all, how did you meet Bill Pullman? And how did you guys come up with this idea to start it like this? Because it's really interesting. But first of all, how did you meet him?
How did I meet him? Through the beauty of music, man. I worked with a band. How did this go? I worked with a band where the father of the singer, it was her band, right? Or she was the artist. Her father knew Bill because her father is like a philanthropist, like a very famous explorer, I think. And he knew Bill. So we did a little shindig in the backyard one day and I got called for the gig. And her father invited Bill and his family to come check out his daughter's band. And there was other people there. There was other, you know, celebrities and stuff like that. But I recognized Bill, and you know, I'm not one to get starstruck or anything, and I didn't in this point either. But I just did recognize him from Casper and Independence Day and all that stuff that I used to watch as a kid.
Sure.
I was like, oh, that's pretty awesome. And then I was just walking by Bill, and he was already huddled up with a bunch of fans, I guess, but some people from the band. And I guess they were talking about the band, and he signals me out. Bill signaled me out, and he says, well, this guy right here, this guy, he's doing a great job on the, what is that stuff you're playing? And I was like, oh, hi, good to meet you. Well, that's actually called this and this. And we started talking. That's how it started. Talking music.
What were you playing in that gig? Were you playing like a percussion setup or a drum setup?
Yep. It was a hybrid, like percussion cajon, with some congas, with some chimes, you know, that kind of setup. But I was also playing some folkloric instruments, Colombian folkloric, tambora right. alegre, tambora.
Uh-huh.
So he was asking about those. Why, which later during our, you know, one of my visits to his house, he explained to me his one of his first movies, or I think the first big movie was The Serpent and the Rainbow, where they're in Haiti and they're playing all these Haitian drums, folkloric drums. And after the shooting of the movie, he brought those drums to his house. He was able to take those drums home. So he has the collection of those drums in his house. So he was really, you know, interested in the folkloric aspect of the drums I was playing. You know, wrapped in goat head, you could still see the flaps of the goat skin on the sides and right. all that stuff. So yeah, man, we were just cool. I wasn't acting like a fan. You know, we were just talking music. I let him do his thing, and then later on in the house, he comes in and he takes a selfie with me and takes a selfie with all of us, and we just kicked it off, and then. You know, we exchanged emails and then I invited him to some other gigs and stuff like that. He invited me to some gigs because his daughter is, well, all his sons and daughters are musical.
Oh,
they have a band. So he invited me to some of those things and I went and we just, you know, the relationship took off. And then we, you know, we had some Thanksgiving at his beautiful home and things like that. And, you know, that's the relationship I have with him now.
Okay.
Very, very, very beautiful. But anyway, yeah, that's how I met him. And then I was talking to him about the album. And he knew that I was making an album and this. And he threw the idea out there. He said, man, it would be nice to open that album up with some spoken word, huh? Or like a nice piece like that. And I said, wow, Bill, that's a great idea. If anyone could help me with a great voice like yours, you know, to do this, you know, hint, hint. And he agreed. And he told me to set up a date. I told him like the next day, are you available the next day? I can get a recording rig and head over to your house. And he was fine with that. And I remember on the way to driving to his house, I was writing the poem.
Oh.
Would you? Yeah. And it just flowed, man. It just came. It just flowed and I had him read it and he was like in love with it. He said, This is amazing. This is beautiful. And then you can hear that he liked it in the recording.
Yeah.
You can hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He yeah. felt it.
That's cool.
That's yeah, cool. Man. So it was like an opening soundtrack to the rest of the album.
Wow.
So I'm really happy about that.
Impromptu. One word that can mean anything or everything. It is the unscripted part of life, the off-camera genius, the behind-the-scenes laughter, the unrehearsed notes that fill the air with joy or nostalgia. It is the road that leads to nowhere but holds the most pleasant arrival. It is what happens when you let go of the wheel and let yourself be driven It will be beauty. It will be pain. It will be light. It will be darkness. For there is none without the other.
Special treat we have for you, Mr. Joe Mater, Mahesh Balasuria, Adonis Panther Calderon, and Mr. Alex Acuna. This is the LA Impromptu Orchestra.
So let's talk about gombops. Let's talk about some of your favorite instruments that you use.
Of course. So my favorite has always been the Tumbao Pro series, everything.
Yeah.
It just feels rugged, feels solid. My little thing is, I like to say that it's the Rolls Royce of percussion. Everything just feels so solid and so right. Me, myself, I have maybe 9 congas at this time. All of them Tumbao Pro series. I have some, I'm not going to say vintage, but maybe late 80s, early 90s gombops congas, which I need to show you because I don't know what they are. Yeah. I don't know what series they are, but they, for recording, they sound great because I have them with Rawhide. And that's what I record everything with, those. I have, I also have a Super Tumba for certain things that I want to create. I can even, I'm even messing around like with some compositions, like orchestral things I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I use the conga with like one of those foam mallets. Mm-hmm. You get a really deep tone, a really cool tone out of it. All my timbales are also Tumbao Pro.
Right.
I have an Oreste Bilato series timbal, which I don't get enough. I get so many compliments, man. It's just like enough already. Yeah. You know, I get so many compliments because of the sound.
Yeah,
the way I like to do certain things to my drum heads to make them sound a certain way, using little tips and tricks and that I pick up, you know, like to tape them off and stuff like that, just to get a different sound. Yeah, so a lot of people love that.
I also see you use the Orestes Vilato timbales a lot too.
Yeah, those are the ones I'm talking about, the Vilato. I don't know if you mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get the compliments on the Orestes series. And I just got some new recording timbales because I separate them from my live gig stuff.
Right.
And my recording stuff. I just got some brass shell.
The Alex Acuna model.
Alex Acuna brass shell timbales, yeah. Man. Those sound good.
So you actually have all three of our timbales. Then you have the Tumbao, which is now the Luisito Quintero
yes.
model. Which the reason for that if some people don't know, Lucito was instrumental in helping us create that in the beginning when it was called Tumbao Series. So we put his name attached to it because he helped us make those.
That's right.
And then Alex's and then Oreste's, a whole different animal, but also very cool. Well, we also got a question today, very interestingly enough. When I announced this podcast interview, I used your new photograph that you gave us for your new bio in the story, in the Instagram and Facebook story. And somebody had written to us and said, "Do you guys carry those congas?" So talk about how you got that. Where did you get that custom finish that you did on your congas?
So if anybody sees my custom congas, I basically call them my childhood, because it has a bunch of video game characters, a bunch of anime characters. I'm very influenced by Japanese anime, Nintendo series things. That I picked up that wrap. It's actually a vinyl wrap.
Yep.
You know, I took all the decals off and everything, vinyl wrapped it myself. Which is something, you know, as we progress, you know.
So you
maybe
I'm going to stop you. So you wrapped it yourself and you put all those decals.
Actually, I found that's all one wrap.
Okay.
With all those, you know, I chose the figurines,
right,
and stuff like that. So it's all on one wrap.
So you had somebody come put that together for you and print it out for the.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. On vinyl wrap. And then I, you know, wrapped it myself. I did everything myself.
Very cool.
Yeah, man. Which is maybe another cool thing that Gombos would have down the line. You know?
Well, it's a very personal, individual thing you did. I mean, it's your influence from your early days of video games and all the characters and the anime that you like. It's
right.
It's a very colorful, cool wrap.
Yeah.
You don't see anything like that. That's one of a kind.
I'm actually doing all of it. All the Tumbao Pros, all my extra Tumbao Pros that I have, I'm wrapping them. So I'm making a whole set. Even the timbal, man, because you know what? I thought it was going to opaque the sound. Mm-hmm. The rap was going to like dull the sound. It doesn't, doesn't dull the sound of the timbal. So I'm going to, you know, when I have time, I'm going to wrap the timbal too.
Oh, it's a cool wrap. It's a very colorful, cool thing. I have to look at it again now, knowing that it's anime. It's because there's so much going on in there. It's like a...
Mm-hmm.
There's so many characters.
Yeah. There's cartoons in there too.
Yeah.
You know.
But everybody though. So he's talking about, that's our Tumbao series congas. So that's what he uses. On those drums, are you using natural hide or using synthetic?
Those are my lives, so I'm using synthetics.
Okay.
On all of that, yeah. So people are gonna have to wait for the Calderon series of congas to get those cool anime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, you use mainly synthetic heads when you're playing live, and then when you record, you like the more natural hide, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It just gives it a more vibrance, more it's brighter.
Yeah.
You can hear the each hit individually. It's better. It's just better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as things go on here, obviously we're going to stay in touch with how things progress for you live, because we're going to want to let people know when you're doing this band live somewhere. Think that we're closer now than we have been getting out of this thing that we've been living through for the past 2 years. I think it's getting closer. I don't want to jump to conclusion, but I think we are getting closer. I'm still seeing a lot of live work going out there, but I'm also seeing a lot of cancellations still. So
yeah.
I was on the phone actually recently with Danny Reyes, and Zach Brown's going out in April, and just talked to Lenny Castro, and he's in rehearsals with John Mayer right now, and they're going out in February. So things are happening. It's slowly, you know, there's a lot of precautions still. But I think it's, you know, and then we talk to our friends, right? And like Eliel's doing gigs over in Europe, and Yasmani Santos in Africa seems to be playing quite a bit. And you're still doing live gigs here occasionally.
Yeah.
So it's we're finding our way through it, you know?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. It's all about, you know, working from the studio as much as you can, getting all these recordings and stuff. for the, you know, for the time being.
Yeah.
Which I like better, to be honest with you. But yeah, I am still pretty busy doing live gigs, and I like doing them, you know, but I want to see if we could take it in a different direction. Just focus on my project more, focus on those, on a studio more, at least, you know.
Yeah, you're still setting things up in your new place in the LA area, right?
That's right.
That's next. And then you're going to start working on the next album, and Well, you got to keep us posted, of course.
Yes, of course, man. I'm here to stay.
Yeah. Well, if anybody wants to ask you any questions or reach out to you, they know they can reach you through social media. They can also send us questions. We're happy to send information your way, or, you know, any interest in, tell people where they can find your album.
You can find everything actually at willycalderon.com. So that's probably your hub to get the links to, for everything. You know, you can either stream the album. I encourage you to buy the physical copy.
Yes.
Because you can hold it in your hands. It looks better. I personalize every copy.
Where do they buy the physical CD? Where do you?
Well, there's a link, but I do it through eBay.
Okay.
I do it through eBay because it's the easiest, and it's they're very reliable. So and I can get the CD in my hands, so I can, you know, sign it and personalize it before it goes out. So I like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. WillyCalderon.com, and you can find me on Instagram too, Willie Calderon Official. YouTube channels. I'm always putting something musical related. You can see all that stuff that I was talking about, the trailers and the live gigs, the tour vlogs. I'm going to do, you know, put out a lot of stuff. So,
well, listen, man, this is great having you here. We're going to continue to collaborate together and come up with new ideas to do things. And, good luck with your settling into your new place. That's awesome. That's a great area you're living in. I like it over there a lot.
Thanks. Dude, the inspiration is going to be crazy.
Yeah, of course.
Awesome, bro.
Yeah, man. Well, everybody, again, Willie, thank you so much. And we'll stay in close touch very soon, okay?
Of course. See you later.
Check out this album. It is one of the best records I've heard in a long, long time. It's a must-have. Thank you, everybody. We'll see everybody soon. Take care. Bye-bye.